A few years ago, I realized that paying my money to the federal government was buying a lot of things that I felt were illegal and immoral. I realized that if the government came to my door, or somebody came to my door and said, would you pay for this policy or pay for this weapon? I would, of course, say no. And when they do it by mail, under the guise of law, it is no different in terms of my conscience.
Of an MX missile, for instance, would more than compensate for the great poverty that exists for a whole year here in West Virginia.
But I'm not paying for war. I'm not paying no more. I'm not paying for war. I'm not paying no more.
I have carried this sign around for so long. A thief says your money or your life. The Pentagon says your money and your life, and I refuse to give either one.
War tax resistance seems to be a growing phenomenon in the United States. We find out who is doing it and why right now on Alternative Views. The centerpiece of this Alternative Views is a documentary by Carol Coney called Paying for Peace, spotlighting war tax resistance in the United States. We'll find out who the people are, the very brave people, who are doing this. We'll see some of their activities in addition to tax withholding. And the reasons why. The history of U.S. intervention in other countries, militarism at home. But before we see our documentary, here is a special report on the October surprise story, perhaps the most significant story since World War II, maybe since the Civil War. In 1987, Alternative Views did its first story on the October surprise. And it was an enormous surprise to a lot of people because people wouldn't think that, oh, that couldn't happen in the United States where there's a democracy. This story about how the people in the running the campaign for Ronald Reagan against Carter had conspired with the Iranians so that the Iranians would keep the American hostages until after Reagan was elected. Because they knew if they released the hostages before the election, that Carter would probably win. In return, the Americans promised to give the Iranians arms and to free their frozen assets in the United States. Well, finally, in 1991, the establishment media come out with a story as if it's something brand new. And is it so funny? Why is this? Well, it seems that an establishment person finally decided to do something about it, to write about it, a person in the Carter administration. He was pretty high up, wasn't he? This Gary Sick?
Right. Gary Sick was a member of the Carter administration. He was on the staff of the National Security Council from August of 1976 to April of 1981 with responsibility for monitoring Iran policy. He served under Ford, Carter, and Reagan with the National Security Council. So he's an establishment figure. He's now a professor at Columbia University. And he was writing a book on U.S.-Iranian dealings during the Reagan and Carter years and kept stumbling upon this October surprise story, that this deal was cut, to hold the hostages until after the election. They were released. Then arms started flowing from Israel to Iran, and the hostages were held until after the election. At first, he didn't believe this. He simply doubted that this story was true, even though rumors had been flying about this for years.
But he's acting as if this is something he just stumbled upon, and yet there were large articles in the alternative press, which had been printed years before, and very with a lot of good documentation.
Right.
And I think it's also interesting that they said that they contacted the Dukakis campaign people and asked them, why didn't they use this? And the Dukakis people said, well, gosh, we talked to some people in the establishment media and the major media, and they said we'd be laughed off of the lecture stage if we were to say anything like this. So, but John Stockwell had another interpretation of this, didn't he? That they refused to use it, even though they knew about it.
Well, all the establishment media had it. Stockwell and a large number of people spoke with television producers, with New York Times people, Washington Post, and they just simply would not touch this story. It was too hot to handle. Although then Gary Sick came out with it, and suddenly Donahue is having a show about it. ABC had a two or three night lines about it. PBS had a front line about it, and it's just about every week you'll see a story in the news.
Well, what has he come up with that's new compared to what was known back in 1987?
He has some new sources and some new pieces of the puzzle. He reports in this New York Times op-ed piece that was published on April the 5th of 1991 that when he was working for the Carter administration in December of 1979 and January of 1980, two brothers came to him, Cyrus and Yashid Hashimi, who had contact with Iran. They were pushing a certain democratization and liberalization program for Iran. They also were trying to cut a deal to get the hostages released. They saw this as a reactionary ploy by the clerics to keep contacts from the West from developing. So Sick was talking to these fellows and trying to enter into negotiations with them, and then suddenly they disappeared, and the deal was not cut between the Iranians and the Carter administration to release the hostages. Well, Sick said that Cyrus Hashimi died in 1986, only months after his cooperation with the U.S. Customs Service in a dramatic sting operation that resulted in the arrest of several American, Israeli, and European arms dealers who were engaged in illegal arms sales to Iran. At the same time, the Reagan administration was illegally selling arms to Iran. Certain other arms dealers were arrested for doing the same thing that had been banned by U.S. Law. Well, Cyrus cooperated with U.S. Customs. He told a lot of stories, and then he mysteriously died. Well, his brother, Yamshid, who was also involved in all these arms sales, international arms sales, began talking to Gary Sick. He had some interviews with him, and he told him an interesting story. And that is that, according to Mr. Hashimi, William Casey, who became Ronald Reagan's campaign manager, met with him in late February or early March 80 at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C., and that Casey quickly made it clear to Hashimi that he wanted to make a deal with him to keep the hostages in Iran until after the election so that Carter would not benefit from their release and it could be used as evidence that Carter was ineffective in foreign policy, that he was a weak, incompetent leader. Well, a lot of meetings started taking place between Casey and other members of the Reagan election team and these Iranians to cut the deal. According to Mr. Hashimi, there were some key meetings in a Madrid hotel in July of 1980 where an important Iranian cleric, Mr. Karoubi, who's now the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, met with Mr. Casey to cut a deal to make sure that the hostages were not released, and they had a second meeting in Madrid several weeks later where the negotiations went a step further. Well, during the fall, a couple of months after these meetings where it appeared that a deal had been cut with the Iranians were suddenly desperate for spare parts because they were involved in a war with Iraq. All of their spare parts for their weapon systems were American because the U.S. had armed them because the Shah was one of their top military allies. So all of their weapon systems were American ones. They needed all kinds of replacement weapons, spare parts from the Americans, which had banned weapon sales to Iran because they were holding the hostages. Well, Iran, it appeared, was about to cut a deal with the Carter administration to release the hostages immediately in order to get the spare parts. And it was at this point that the Reagan team really got into high gear. They started dealing with the Iranians in Washington and finally cut a deal in Paris that cut off the Iranians negotiating with Carter and that secured the deal with the Reagan team, in which the hostages would be held until after the election, and already they would start getting spare parts from the Israelis. And Sick claims that he talked to Israeli arm dealers who were involved in this negotiation and Israeli intelligence people, as well as a vast number of people on the American side who were present at these meetings and that were involved in these negotiations, including George Bush.
Mm-hmm. There were now, I think, five people who will have testified or at least have given information to Gary Sick that they saw Bush there.
Right.
There were three people who flew with Bush over to the to Paris who said they took that ride with George Bush. And Donald Gregg was also there.
And then William Casey.
Yes, it's also interesting now. Donald Gregg, he at the time was working for President Carter. He was a CIA liaison man to President Carter. So he was going behind his own boss's back, as were about 130 other people who were involved in actual covert action headed by Casey against a sitting president of the United States, President Carter. And this included theft of top secret information. It included people, even generals, who were supposedly should have been loyal to their commander-in-chief. They were working against him. It was a model of a covert action which is being used against a third world country.
In fact, it could involve treason. It was widely reputed or widely reported and believed that the Carter administration was planning a last-minute hostage rescue when the Iranians were refusing to cut this deal. Gary Sick claims that this was the case, and he was part of the team that was negotiating this. And somehow this information leaked. And it's believed that it leaked to Richard Allen, who was the head of Reagan's October Surprise team that was dealing with all the facets of the Iranian hostage situation. And it's believed that Richard Allen told the Iranians that a secret covert action was about to take place to release the hostages, and the hostages suddenly were taken from where they were being held and were dispersed all over the country, so that it would be impossible to have this covert action to liberate the hostages because the Iranians knew about it. So that would be treason. If Gregg or someone working for the Carter administration told Richard Allen and he told the Iranians, that's heavy duty.
Well, there's also another interesting aspect from the conspiratorial point of view, and that is the first and that unsuccessful rescue operation was being run by General Secord.
Right.
And Oliver North was a big person on the ground who was doing head coordination activities there, so they could very easily have sabotaged the whole thing. So it makes you wonder how much of that was really just happenstance and how much was poor planning and how much of it was of the fact that it didn't work was sabotage by these people who would later be biggies in the covert activities of the Reagan administration.
Right. Carter was basically the victim of one of the most highly developed and one of the most illegal covert operations in U.S. history.
It was a coup.
It was a coup d'etat by people that would later take over the government and regularly engage in all kinds of covert operations of this type. Now, some new information came out last week that was published in the London Financial Times and on ABC News. It was telecast. They reported that William Casey's former secretary claimed that his records could not account for his whereabouts at the time that these meetings were alleged to have taken place in Madrid with the Iranians and then later in Paris. This was a time when Casey was running the campaign of Ronald Reagan, and for several days he wasn't to be seen in the United States during the time that these meetings were being held in Paris.
We'll have some more information on the October surprise story later in the program after we see our documentary about war tax resistance. Who is doing it? Why are they doing it? And what are the consequences of their activities? The documentary is by Carol Coney, and it's entitled Paying for Peace.
A few years ago, I realized that paying my money to the federal government was buying a lot of things that I felt were illegal and immoral. I realized that if the government came to my door, or somebody came to my door and said, would you pay for this policy or pay for this weapon? I would, of course, say no. And when they do it by mail, under the guise of law, it is no different in terms of my conscience.
I became a war tax refuser because of my Christian beliefs. I became a conscientious objector first. Of course, the definition of a conscientious objector is one who cannot participate in war in any form. Well, one form of participating in war, of course, is to pay for it. And it makes no sense to me to be unable to pick up a gun and kill people and yet at the same time somehow be able to pay somebody else to pick up a gun and kill people.
So for me, if we're going to work for peace, at least for me personally, and I would think for someone who's really serious about being a peacemaker, that we have to look at what we're doing with our tax money as well. That should be a very important consideration within the whole process of being a peacemaker.
We shall live in peace. We shall.
Okay, our purpose here is to express a resentment and opposition to the amount of money that goes to the defense budget, while at the same time, huge amounts of money could be directed to the poor people, not only of West Virginia, but throughout this country. The cost of an MX missile, for instance, would more than compensate for the great poverty that exists for a whole year here in West Virginia.
I have a check here for $800 that I'd like to present to the Good Neighbor Program of Grafton. Carol Colbank is accepting, and Sandy Withers will describe the agency.
We're an information and referral service for all the agencies in the county. And also, we have a little bit of emergency money that we use to help people that are in a crisis situation and are not eligible for any other services in the county. So our funds have been drastically cut. Our first year of operation, we got $4,500. This year, we've been cut to $1,200, and we were afraid we were going to have to shut down. But thanks to you all, it looks like we're going to be able to stay open next year. So we really appreciate this money. Thanks a lot.
A fundamental motivation for war tax refusal within the peace movement should be this. We've found, for instance, I made about $30,000 last year in income as a carpenter. My wife, who is also a tax refuser, made about $15,000. She prevented the withholding of the tax by claiming extra allowances on the W-4 form. We were able to donate thousands of dollars in time and in refused war tax money to causes that work for peace and justice.
The intent here is not to evade taxes. We want to pay our full share of taxes, but we wanted to do that in a way that's consonant with our perception of the law the moral, the legal, and the conscience of the individuals involved. Mm-hmm. And we want to spend these dollars for supporting non-military, non-violent government programs.
The real turning point for me was when I went to Central America and I saw for myself what my money was doing. I saw for myself so many victims of the war, and so I not only knew about what my money was doing, I saw my money out there. That was my money killing those people, and that was the last straw for me.
For me, tax resistance is a form of civil obedience. All the treaties that my government signs are part of the supreme law of the land. When they violate those treaties, they are violating the law. And when they are violating the law, they are violating my law, the law that I live under. And under Nuremberg, which my government also signed, I have a duty to not pay those taxes. I have a duty to not participate in violations of the law. I also have a duty in trying to stop my government from continuing to violate the law.
The First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees the right to free exercise of religion. And for constitutional purposes, religion includes moral and spiritual beliefs that aren't ordinarily considered part of traditional religious beliefs. A lot of people have brought cases in the tax court and in the federal courts trying to establish that there is a constitutional right under the First Amendment to conscientious objection to military taxation. All of the courts that have considered this argument have rejected it and have decided that there is no such constitutional right. The Supreme Court has never decided a case on this question, but has said in an unrelated case that they would not recognize the right to conscientious objection to military taxation. But we're talking about very fundamental social change. And in the history of this country, fundamental social change has had to take place on a lot of different levels, including direct action, political action through the legislature and litigation.
But I'm not paying for war. I'm not paying no more. I'm not paying for war. I'm not paying no more.
I had tried to figure out for years how you could be a tax resister without having any consequences. You know, the have your cake and eat it too syndrome. And I realized, well, you know, you got to start paying the price for peace. And if I wanted to be honest with my conscience, maybe the payment I was going to have to be asked to pay was a jail sentence or a fine, which I conceivably would not pay. But that there was no safe or easy, quote, safe or easy way out of a revolution of consciousness.
Our revolution was based on the sovereignty of the people and revolutionary tax refusal. And we are in the fix that we are in today because we do not believe in the sovereignty of the people and the power of the people. When we ask a senator to vote against military appropriations and to follow his conscience, we're asking him to risk his job, to risk the loss of his job, if he believes that he could be politically challenged for following his conscience and voting against these military appropriations. We have the gall to go and ask them to risk their jobs. But when it comes time for us, when the time for the appropriations process in our budget comes around, the time for appropriations, when we get to sit down and write out the check and appropriate things for public good, then do we turn around and ask ourselves, do we realize that we have the power of appropriation? Do we take back to ourselves the power of appropriation? And are we willing to risk our job security in order to deny appropriations, to vote against appropriations for the Pentagon? It's a question we have to ask ourselves.
Well, in September of 1939, war was just breaking out in Europe, and I was realizing for the first time that I was a pacifist when a conscription act passed, and I realized that I would not be offering myself for military service. And in the Congress of 1941, a law was passed which exacted from every auto owner a certain stamp tax. And I was considering about that tax when on the 7th of December of that year, the United States Navy was attacked in Pearl Harbor, and my beliefs became more solidified as I thought of my role in, if not really entering the military, by supplying the arms for somebody else to fight perhaps in my place.
Of course, people in this country have gotten very used to having the federal government take large sums of money out of their pay. But it's a fact to some of us older people that ordinary working people never paid federal income taxes until the years just preceding World War II. I never paid any income taxes until about 1937, 38, something like that. And to us, the war part of federal taxes is the thing that's just so obvious.
If we won't take work in a war plant, or if we don't do other things like joining the army or supporting military ventures, then why do we spend perhaps 3 days a week out of the five working in our job to supply these military means and supply all this research which goes into all these weapons?
I would say that some of the worst crimes in history have occurred under a totally legal setup. You only have to think about Nazism, the furnaces and all that. Those were all legal. And that's only one example of many, many crimes which were committed by legal authorities.
And I think it comes back to the matter of Gandhi's belief, his sort of belief anyway, in nonviolence. Because he maintained up to his death that the supreme law is the law of nonviolence, and that it's far superior to the law of brute force. That if human life is going to continue on this planet, then this law of brute force is going to have to be rejected.
I first started resisting in 1948 in a manner where I knew I was not going to pay under any circumstances. Considering what the situation was in the world, having met Wally Nelson while he was in prison for refusing to be conscripted into the military, and it seemed to me that, or to both of us, when he got out of prison and we started living together, that it didn't make much sense to support with our money that which he wasn't supporting, to the point where he was got a five-year sentence. We did not pay, we have never filed since that time. I'd say that war tax resistance has probably changed my life a great deal. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about war tax resistance. You start doing that. I think it's, I like to say, I think of it as neither the beginning of something nor the end of something. It's on the road to it. It certainly has meant having to use a lot of ingenuity in earning one's living. It has led me to think a lot about both what work is, about how much money one should earn, that sort of thing. It has led us finally to the place where we're trying, not because we don't want to pay the taxes, that isn't it, but it has led us to think in terms of what is our share of the world's resources, and has led us now to the place where in Western Massachusetts we're living really on a rather subsistence level and raising 80% of our own food, selling produce for our livelihood. And that would be a long story, but I think it really has to do partly with having started on this road of tax resistance. I do not do things for, in quotes, results. I mean, I'm very happy for it. That's what I want. But I really do think that if any appreciable number of people would refuse their taxes, it would make a difference. I really do think so. If nothing else, it would be the defiance. You know, most people, you just can't, how can you not pay taxes? People are terribly amazed that it can be done. I never will forget one time when Wally picked up a hitchhiker who was in the military, who was really intrigued by this whole thing, and apparently had been quite well read, and he came to supper, and he said, well, you know, I knew that in the days of Thoreau people refused taxes, but I didn't know you could do it today. You know, I mean, it's like, how can you, even the people, you know, you can't do it. It's just impossible. You know, death and taxes are inevitable.
Well, the first time that I broke the law on any cause was the non-payment of taxes. That was on the tax returns for 1948. And then I think it was in 55 that I first refused to file. And then on September 10th, they ordered me to appear before the IRS to account for the money I wasn't paying. And on the 12th, the marshals came by, and at the top of their order, they said, "You are instructed to bring the body of Morris F. McCracken." So they carried me in, and then I was brought into court, and I wouldn't cooperate, and I was told I was taken back to county jail and to be held until I purged myself of contempt. Well, you know, they use these words. It means one thing to me and to us and another thing to them. I'd have felt contemptuous if I'd gone against my conscience and testified. So Judge Druffel asked what I pled, and I said, I'm just pleading that we quit making bombs and things to kill each other and we begin living in peace. This is my plea. And so then I just sat on the floor. So they took it to the jury, and 12 minutes they decided I was guilty. It shouldn't take them that long, as far as I wasn't, nobody denying that I hadn't appeared, and that was the point at which they were making the charge.
And I have carried this sign around for so long. A thief says your money or your life. The Pentagon says your money and your life, and I refuse to give either one.
In the past 40 years, no one has been criminally prosecuted simply for refusing to pay an amount of war taxes. Some people have been prosecuted and some people have gone to prison for other activities related to war tax resistance, such as refusing to file a tax return or filing a false W-4 form or for refusing to comply with an IRS summons. Other people are far more concerned with the financial consequences of war tax resistance than with the possibility of imprisonment. If one has a regular salaried job, one's salary can be subject to IRS collection. If one owns property, cars, or a house, for example, it's possible that the IRS will seize these things. People who are in employment, which subjects them to withholding, may find themselves completely altering their job situations in order to become self-employed so that they can get control over their tax money to prevent the government from collecting it from them through withholding. These kinds of economic consequences can be fairly drastic and long-term consequences.
Were glued on the IRS office in Greenfield as the bids were opened. Randy Keeler and his wife Betsy Corner stood waiting.
I'm afraid of losing my home. We've always known that we might lose it. I feel just tremendously exhilarated by all the community support for the stand we've taken.
One of their supporters gave a running commentary.
I haven't seen a check yet.
Outside, more than $30,000 worth of food and hours of community service were donated in lieu of cash.
My bid was for one full measure of compassion for the peoples of Central America.
After going through 90 bids ranging from confetti to pledges of pints of blood, an IRS official emerged.
The property has been purchased by the United States government for a minimum bid of $5,100.
The IRS did not receive any money bids. Keeler says he and his wife are going to carry on as if this auction didn't happen.
Well, we don't recognize the legitimacy of this sale. As far as we're concerned, we still own our house. We're the rightful owners. We're going to continue to inhabit it right up until the point, should this point ever come, when they would forcibly remove us.
And that is definitely a possibility.
The purchase of the property for the federal government took place already. Whether there's occupation of the house down the road is speculation. It's something we have to discuss with counsel.
Goldsmith says there haven't been similar cases here in Massachusetts, so no precedent has been set. But Keeler and his wife cite a similar case in Cincinnati where the IRS did give land back to a tax objector. In Greenfield, Deborah Fountain, Newswatch 40.
was really hard for me to leave the library. It had been a good working environment. It had been a great union environment. And, but I just didn't want to pay. And so it was a watershed in the sense that I really came face to face with my fear about economic instability. And I said, and I still want to be a tax resister. You know, I went up to the top of that hill, and then I went down the other side, and I was still in this movement. I think that's a really important thing about tax resistance, is that we have to, each of us individually and as a movement, that we have to confront our fear. And we have to confront it head on. And we have to walk through it to the other side, and then we can go on.
I think of my pacifism or nonviolence, whichever way I use those terms interchangeably, as being all-encompassing. I don't see them as, you know, pacifism over here and my workday life over here or something like that. Therefore, I feel that I have to try to figure out what I call it, sort of like the nonviolence of daily living, for instance. That's one term I use. I have to try to figure out what that means in all my actions.
There's 5 billion people on this earth, and there are a finite number of resources. Right now, 5% of those people live in the United States, and we consume 40% of the resources. Therefore, we cannot have justice in the earth because 5% consume 40%. And we have an army and a central intelligence agency and a number of other mechanisms to assure that our national security, 5% consuming 40%, will remain intact. I'm joining the human race so that I can be free from the being a hostage to my things, so that I can take seriously the notion that I am worth no more than any other person, and that no other person is worth any less than I am.
For information on tax resistance, write the NWTRCC, Box 774, Monroe, Maine, 04951. Turn now to the Alternative Press for some more news stories, starting with the resumption of the October Surprise story.
Now, the question is, where was George Bush during this period of time in October that the deal was cut? High-level negotiations were taking place with Casey, Donald Gregg, and some of the top Iranians. Now, to cut this deal, to secure it, they needed a very high-placed American official. And who could be higher than George Bush? The former head of the CIA in 1976, the vice presidential candidate of Ronald Reagan. There could be no one higher to cut the deal than George Bush. And according to Sick, five people saw him in the meeting in Paris at the time that the deal was closed. Now, Bush so far has not been able to account for his whereabouts about 18 hours when this meeting was alleged to take place. He gave all sorts of excuses of where he was, none of which panned out. So there's circumstantial evidence that he might have indeed been there, and there's a lot of people who claim that they saw him there. One of the people is an Israeli arms dealer, Ben Menashe, who's writing a book about the October surprise, and has told several journalists that he was involved in the arms deal from the Israeli point of view from the very beginning, and he will attest that he saw George Bush at that meeting.
You know, some of these people better be careful, because according to Barbara Harnacker, who wrote the first book on it called October Surprise, in an interview in the Spotlight, she said that 37 individuals have been either assassinated or have tried to commit suicide. These individuals have all been involved in October Surprise.
It's like the Kennedy assassination.
Kennedy assassination, right?
Frank, do you have some information on one of the pilots that was alleged to have flown Bush? One pilot, Heinrich Rupp, was a CIA operative who engaged in all kinds of covert operations for the CIA and was also an arms dealer, and was put in jail for a certain gun deal that he was involved in that was illegal. And he was so angry that the CIA allowed him to go to jail to be incriminated for this deal, that he spilled the beans, that he saw Bush in the Paris airport. And there's another pilot that claims that he actually flew Bush, that he was the guy that flew this airplane that was one of these high-speed airplanes that was fueled midway across the Atlantic by one of these fuel planes. And a California newspaper wrote up his story.
Right, the Napa Sentinel, Harry Martin is the editor, and the Spotlight has been having a series of interviews with him, and also it's been quoting extensively from this series. And all three of the pilots involved in this, the other was Brennecke, in addition to Rupp. Now, we've talked about Brennecke a lot. He was one of the first people who blew the whistle on October Surprise, and he was involved in the illegal arms operations to the Contras. Well, the third one is a Navy captain by the name of Günter Rusbacher. Now, if that sounds like a Nazi name to you, well, it pretty well is. He was born in Salzburg, Austria in 1942. His parents were part of the Gehlen intelligence organization for the Nazis, and they were they had to leave Austria after the war. They came from royalty, the royal family there, and high connection with big business as well. But anyway, they had to leave because they'd been too close to working with the Nazis, so naturally they came to the United States. Well, Rusbacher first entered the U.S. Army, got security clearances and cryptographic operations, which is very unusual for somebody who is of foreign extraction to get those types of clearances. But anyway, he went through all types of activities in the Army, and then he got out for a while. He worked with the CIA here and there. He used the Connecticut Mutual School for Advanced Planning and Harvard as a front for some of his other operations. And he was one of these kind of, not a soldier of fortune, you might call him an intelligence operative. He went all over the world, in Afghanistan and Latin America and different places in Europe, in various different types, in the Middle East as well.
anywhere the CIA would want to send this guy, they would send him. He was a very, very good pilot, and they had him checked out on the SR-71 Blackbird, which is the fastest plane in the world. Well, like so many people at this particular level who were very clever covert operatives, he would be caught from time to time doing illegal activities. But when he was caught and taken to court, certain whispers would be made and he would be let go, and then the trial and all the records would be sealed. Well, he did run into trouble, and that nobody helped him out of so far, and at the present time, as we record this, he actually is in jail for impersonating a naval officer and supposedly resisting, not resisting arrest, but having misuse of government purchase orders and jet fuel. It sounds like one of those things which they wanted to get this guy because he knew he is known too much. But anyway, he is in jail at the present time, but he has been a very key person in flying personnel in this October surprise, and he is talking, so that might save his life.
He claims he's the one that flew Bush across the Atlantic.
And he saw Gregg and Casey and a secretary among the people who were in this. He claimed he stayed in a different hotel in Paris than Bush did, but he has it all nailed down. And Brennecke also has come forth. All the pilots have come forth, and all the pilots are in jail too.
And some of the arms dealers
tried to put them in jail.
Were also starting to talk. On the other hand, heavy hitters in the establishment are looking into this. On June the 13th, there was a symposium in Washington, organized by the Fund for New Priorities, that invited several senators to this symposium, invited a lot of reporters and a lot of researchers, including Gary Sick, and including a lot of the hostages. That eight different former hostages that were held in Tehran wrote an open letter to encourage lawmakers to look into this matter, to have an unbiased, bipartisan congressional investigation with full subpoena power. And the last time that this group, the Fund for New Priorities, had a symposium to investigate a brewing scandal, they had one on the Watergate scandal before the hearings were actually opened. So they're calling for the same kind of Watergate-like hearings to investigate to the full the October surprise.
What is the cost to the Iraqis of George Bush's war in the Gulf? There have been a couple of studies recently which indicate it's a catastrophe. And matter of fact, they're using the word genocide at this time. The UN observers say that they estimate that a half a million Iraqis probably lost their lives, and that the suffering will continue, and many and hundreds of thousands of more could also die, because cholera, typhoid, various form of gastroenteritis, and other types of maladies will occur because of the lack of sanitary services, hospitals being destroyed, bad drinking water. And it seems that not only because of the bombing and all, but the United States still, when we're recording this in late June, the U.S. still has the embargo going on against Iraq. A Harvard Public Health Study team report says that at least 170,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 will die in the coming year because of delayed health effects of this. They say the Johns Hopkins University, doctor there at the School of Hygiene and Public Health, says that malnutrition is widespread and severe in Iraq. There's a general breakdown of the medical care system, lack of medicine, equipment and doctors, water purification facilities, power plants, sewage disposal have been blown apart. And as a result, emergency humanitarian aid on a major scale is needed to alleviate this catastrophe. The British and French delegates to the UN Commission are calling it genocide, and an Austrian doctor who was also on the commission, says that unless Bush is made to yield, the modern equivalent of a medieval plague will descend on Iraq. And no amount of Hollywood victory parades will prevent mankind from calling that the monstrous war crime of a mass murderer.
This is one of the really cynical aftermaths of the war and one of the failures of the media to really cover the suffering of the Iraqi people, in which they merely focused on the suffering of the Kurdish people, who have been manipulated time and time again by the United States for U.S. foreign policy aims. In fact, I read in the Washington Journalism Review that one of the other victims of the Gulf War was network news itself. One of the reasons that the network just haven't been able to cover as much as one would want them to is they've cut back drastically on their news resources after the Gulf War, because after the war, the networks weighed their losses and found that their budgets had been devastated. They spent so much money on their Gulf War coverage, they'd gone in the hole. And to make ends meet, CBS News, for instance, eliminated 400 jobs, closing its Atlanta bureau, laying off some of its veteran correspondents, including Gary Reeves and Bruce Hall, its 22-year veteran John Shahin, who reported the uprising from Tiananmen Square, was let go. And so you've had a devastation of network news teams after the Gulf War simply because of the budgets of these corporations that spent more than they could afford in the heated competition for ratings during the Gulf War, and now are cutting back on their news teams, so we're simply not getting the news that we need about the Gulf or any other key aspects of the world.
And CNN, which made so much money on its Gulf War coverage, what are they doing now? Did they pull out their resources also? You monitor CNN. And,
well, they certainly have not been covering what's been going on in Iraq. They have a Kuwaiti news team. They have covered the Kurdish issue pretty well, but I've seen almost nothing on CNN about the suffering of the Iraqi people. And the Iraqis have allowed foreign journalists to come in. But it must be said, the Iraqi government also has an interest in covering up the extent and amount of the devastation in the war, because if the Iraqi people see the amount of the devastation, they could raise questions about the rationality of Saddam Hussein that Saddam Hussein might not want raised. So there's been almost a conspiracy between the Iraqi government, the U.S. government, and the U.S. media to cover up the suffering of the Iraqi people, because it's in none of the interests of these groups to expose the suffering, to tell the truth about it. But a lot of teams have gone, of American physicians and scientists and doctors from all over the world, that have documented the extent of this devastation, and it is really catastrophic.
And that's the end of another Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We also can provide you with information on how to get some of the publications of former CIA officer John Stockwell. We'd like to thank the crew for our program, Eric Eubank, Kevin L. West, and Brian Lynch. Also to Carol Coney for letting us use her wonderful documentary, Paying for Peace. Her address is P.O. Box 5946, Tacoma Park, Maryland, 20913. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.